court is whether the military judge abused his discretion as gatekeeper in deciding that he hadn't seen enough direct, compelling evidence to say that that second act, that the use of the gun had occurred, and decided to exclude it.
Now, could you address... Did you have further follow-up?
No, not on that point.
Could you address Mathis's testimony? I believe that Mathis at some point was prepared to testify that he warned appellant that Mattson, you have a lot of M's here.
Right,
Mathis,
yes, sir.
Warned appellant that Mattson was after him for the money, and that he, Mathis, perceived appellant to be frightened by the news.
Yes, Your Honor. Ultimately, that second statement, the relaying of the information from Mr. Mattson to Mr. Mathis and then to appellant, theoretically could be testified to as far as the, it wouldn't be for the truth of the matter asserted, but rather the response from appellant at that point. However, the statement that he's relaying is itself hearsay, which the military judge properly excluded as it wasn't an exception under 8033. And the relaying of that information to appellant has to be for the truth of the matter asserted, otherwise it's irrelevant. If Mr. Mathis was to testify, getting rid of the hearsay, saying, I told him something and he was frightened by it, that had absolutely no relevance on the trial. They have to show that the theory of the defense was Mr. Mattson was placing appellant under duress, and this is proof of it. So unless the earlier statement from Mr. Mattson to Mr. Mathis was given for the truth of the matter asserted, it's irrelevant.
So it's the government's view that the government can put on a witness to talk about the defendant's confession. The witness, in the course of that testimony, this is a government witness, says that the appellant told me that he did this because a gun was pointed at him. That the defense cannot then put on evidence that another individual both had a gun, and that individual had said that he was after the appellant and that the appellant looked frightened when he heard that news. And then the government can argue in closing argument that there's nothing to corroborate this story that's put on by the defense.
What the government would argue, the defense quotes Chambers v. Mississippi, and to quote the language from that case to this court.
My question is not about Chambers against Mississippi. I'm proceeding on the assumption that the defendant had the opportunity to put on his defense. My question goes to the question of corroboration and the role of the members, the court martial panel, the jury as fact finders, and what's before them when they're deciding this case.
Certainly.
Can the government put on a government witness who presents this information, then keep off the stand defense witnesses who will corroborate it, and then then the government gets to argue, in effect, that it's not corroborated?
Yes, Your Honor, they certainly can in the case that evidence is kept out legally and lawfully under the rules of evidence. Again, quoting Chambers v. Mississippi, is that there are few rights are more fundamental than that of the accused to present witnesses in his own defense. However, in the exercise of that right, the accused, as is required by the state, must comply with the established rules of procedure and evidence designed to assure both fairness and reliability in the ascertainment of guilt and innocence. When the government has used the rules of evidence to exclude hearsay and irrelevant testimony, certainly during closing they can argue that the appellant was not able to offer any corroboration or direct evidence.
And under what rule is the evidence that by Mathis that appellant was after him for the money and appellant was frightened when he heard that news, under what rule is that excluded?
It's excluded under Rule 803. It's hearsay upon hearsay.
Even though it would show the state of mind of the appellant.
It could. If there wasn't the underlying hearsay, there is a strong argument as to show the effect on the listener of that being appellant. However, the statement that he's relaying to appellant is the prior hearsay statement from Mr. Mattson to Mr. Mathis, and there's no way to separate those two. And because the earlier statement is properly excluded under 803, so is the later.
Could you address, in this case I don't believe was cited by the parties, but it's a recent case of this court, United States against Dobson. It's at 63 MJ1 and I can refresh briefly.
If you could.
That's a premeditated murder case. And that case is a spousal murder in which the defense of the spouse was that she was a victim of spousal abuse. And the question there was not a, was, there were a number of questions of defense, but ultimately what the court, our court focused on was the difference between premeditated and unpremeditated murder. And focusing on that, we focused on the intent of the defendant in the case. In that case, there were two witnesses who were excluded, both of whom could talk about conversations that took place with third parties that would show the content of that conversation was excluded by the judge, and our court ruled that that was error because the content of those conversations and the defendant's reaction on it would be important information for the panel members to consider on the issue of intent for purposes of distinction between premeditation and unpremeditated murder. Why isn't that what we have here as well? There's a content of the conversation. That conversation was relayed to the appellant. The appellant had a reaction to it. Why would this case be any different from Dobson in terms of allowing that content in to show the state of mind?
On the state of mind between premeditated and non-premeditated murder, certainly the intent of the appellant at that point is an issue. In this case, the intent of the appellant is not an issue.
But the state of mind is at issue. That is this someone who is operating under duress, or someone who is just your garden variety criminal?
Your Honor, I'd have to read Dobson. I'm assuming here that it must have come under the residual exception to hearsay and that it was constitutionally required. At some point in this court-martial, the military judge actually, the defense counsel somewhat alluded to the fact that he needed this information for a fair trial. The military judge asked the defense counsel if he was raising this under the residual exception of hearsay, and the defense counsel said he was not, that they were trying to bring it in under 8033. And case law is replete with the military judge does not abuse his discretion for excluding evidence when a defense counsel asks that it be introduced under a certain rule, but does not say that it should also be coming in under this rule.
Can I ask you, I'd like to ask you about another statement with respect to 8033, which is the statement by Mathis that Mattson had told it, the statement by Mathis regarding Mr. Mattson, that he was like that, he's going to go to Jacksonville to get his money back from Isaac, Lance Corporal Robertson, and he was going to get it back. Why isn't that statement admissible under 8033 to show that, in fact, Mattson did act in conformity with what he told Mr. Mathis that he was going to do? And how is it, or what case should we rely on for the opinion of the lower court that seemed to suggest that it was okay to not admit that evidence because there had been no credible evidence of subsequent acts by Mr. Mattson?
That, it's again the exact...
When whether there was subsequent acts by Mr. Mattson is entirely the issue in the case.
It is, Your Honor. This is the same argument as to whether or not the military judge was to abuse his discretion in excluding the evidence about Mr. Mattson owning a gun as irrelevant. The military judge, as gatekeeper, it's not specifically a case that has this situation that's come up, but rather, as gatekeeper under 402, although the statements of the subsequent acts had come in under the self-serving hearsay, the military judge had said that at that time he wasn't persuaded that there was any direct and sufficient evidence of this subsequent act. Comparing that to Lance Corporal Revelle's testimony regarding the deposit of the check, the military judge found that there was a subsequent act of a check being deposited on December 18th.
But where in 8033 does it tell us that in addition to being not hearsay, if it falls within the exception, that it's not hearsay and can be admitted only if there's a subsequent evidence to show that the subsequent act actually took place? If someone says, Lance Corporal Benatz told me that he hated his wife and he was going to go and murder her, and then the wife is murdered, and Lance Corporal Benatz is on trial for murder, okay? Isn't that evidence admissible even though we don't have Lance Hoover-Bernard with a knife murdering his wife, but isn't it admissible as evidence from which the members can draw the inference that Lance Hoover-Bernard, in fact, acted as he told someone he was going to and went and murdered his wife?
The difference in your hypothetical, Your Honor, is that we have a dead body in that one, that the wife has been murdered.
And we have someone committing an offense here that the assertion is it was based on duress. How is it different?
The only assertion on how it was caused by duress is through the self-serving hearsay of appellant that he was forced by gunpoint. There was no otherwise eyewitness testimony, no statements otherwise entered. Anybody subject to cross-examination or under oath saying that this had occurred. So there's no, according to the military judge and his gatekeeping function, there's no credible evidence.
But then we go back to the question that I think Judge Baker may have started with, which is, if there's no credible evidence of duress, why did the military judge give the duress instruction? How can there not be evidence sufficient for purposes of admitting this other evidence that would corroborate the duress defense on the one hand, and on the other hand, the military judge has sufficient evidence to instruct the members?
It's a matter of the military judge's hands being tied, that by having this evidence that he otherwise would exclude as self-serving hearsay and would not allow in, the fact that he had to allow that in under the rule of completeness, then put it before the members, but still not credibly to the point where he has to consider it. The members...
Is it for him to judge credibility in a member's trial?
It's for him to judge credibility, Your Honor, as to whether or not there's sufficient evidence to make things relevant or to fit under an exception of hearsay, not for him to decide credibility of the evidence in general, which is why once that evidence had been admitted, the appellant's self-serving hearsay, he had to instruct the members regarding the defense of duress and allow them to consider that for the truth of the matter asserted. But when he was performing his gatekeeping function, he did not have to consider that as being credible. He is able to look at the evidence and decide that he doesn't have any direct evidence of this alleged prior, alleged subsequent act by Mr. Madsen having occurred.
So you can't agree that evidence that someone said that they were going to go up and get their money back and evidence that that person had a gun is evidence from which members could have inferred that he had a gun, took the gun, and threatened Lance Hoover-Roberson?
Not without any direct compelling evidence that there was a subsequent act. If there hadn't been any testimony about a pellet, take out...
I'm sorry, step back. What subsequent act would you like to see? I mean, what are you talking about when you say subsequent act?
Some evidence that there was an altercation that caused the duress. If there was testimony of somebody completely not mentioned in trial, but that he hated appellant and that he was going or he thought appellant owed him money and he was going to get it, but there was no evidence that Mr. X was going to come after appellant or that he actually did, that would be completely irrelevant to the trial here because there would be no evidence that appellant was placed in duress by Mr. X. There has to be the subsequent act for it to come in under 8033 for the purpose that the appellant sought to do so at trial.
Assuming, without you conceding that there is error here, that the military judge abuses discretion on one or more of these statements, what standard of prejudice should we be applying?
Harmless error, Your Honor.
And that is because...
It doesn't rise to the level of a constitutional violation. The cases cited by appellant all deal with issues. When appellant speaks of complete defense, citing California versus Trombetta, that refers to the constitutional guarantees of access to evidence. Other cases that he has cited deal with the allowance of a mitigation expert during a capital case, or in the case of Barnes, that the military judge, based on an improper understanding of whether or not...
If you present your defense, so we'll stipulate that you get to present your defense, but aspects of it are excluded, can that never be constitutional error?
It could be... It would certainly, as the appellant cited earlier, this court in 2E2 had a discussion regarding whether something went to the heart of the defense and whether or not that rose to the level of the constitutional. In the case that absolutely essential evidence that could have, much like the evidence that this court spoke of in McAllister with the if appellate had been granted
in that. Trying to pin down absolutely essential is your phrase, and the appellant used a number of phrases. Do you want to focus us on a particular one? Is vital a valid test?
If I were to write the decision, I think heart of the defense, Your Honor. I think heart of the defense is a good term, and I believe that was used by this court in 2E2.
So, just to be clear, the fact that you get to put on your argument is not the end of the analysis. Is that correct?
That is not, Your Honor, no. If there is improperly excluded evidence that caused the appellant an inability, but the in McAllister, where this court reviewed the
Okay, using the heart of the defense argument or standard, why is or is not the having a witness who's neutral rather than your own words being played back on behalf of the appellant, which may have some inherent self-interest involved, why isn't it, does it not go to the heart of the defense to have a neutral witness come in and validate what you've said?
Your Honor, initially the government would disagree with the term neutral that appellant likes to phrase Mr. Mathis as. There is testimony in the record. The trial counsel did ask whether he was a friend of Mr. Mathis, and he was. So it's not truly a neutral third party.
So from the government's position is a third party.
a third party, and in this case, the evidence is not of a material or a quality that would have won in the day and doesn't even come close to rising to any kind of standard that this court would.
What about the granularity of knowing the motive that Mattson might have, that he's not just any person out there with a gun, but someone who thinks the appellant owes him money for drugs?
It certainly is a...
Why does that not go to the heart of the defense, which is the missing ingredient here, which is why is there duress? That seems to go to the heart of it. What's the theory, the heart of the theory of the duress is what I'm talking
about. It's not the heart of the theory. The heart of the theory of the duress is that the appellant was placed in immediate fear, and that was before the members, and the idea that he had told his roommate that he did all of these actions because he had a gun to his head. As far as the members' perspective, why somebody put a gun to his head would not be as relevant as whether or not the appellant reasonably had apprehension of immediate harm or death. And looking at the entire Weeks case, the Weeks test, when the strength of the government case to the strength of the defense case, third, the materiality of the question for whether or not there's an adequate substitute, the government wins on basically all four of these parts. The government's case was strong and compelling. They produced the checks. They produced the false statement by appellant to his bank that his ATM card had been stolen and that his PIN had been compromised. They provided, most importantly, a sworn confession from the appellant where he refers to Mattson as his a civilian, not referring to him as an assailant, but rather as a friend, and says that they conspired together to seal these checks and deposit them. And ultimately, in comparison to the government's strength of the government's case, the defense case was weak, plausible, or implausible and feeble. The appellant was unable to explain why during the almost 3 weeks between the times he stole the checks and he deposited the third after forging it, or the second check after forging it, why he was not able to notify any authorities. And most importantly,
we as a matter of theory, with the appellant's argument, not necessarily their position, but their argument that you could have duress on one specification but not another?
You could. There's a possibility here of duress for the larceny but not for the forgeries. That would have been perhaps a stronger argument for appellant to raise at trial, but ultimately the issue here is whether or not the military judge abused his discretion and whether or not, even if the court finds that they did, whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And ultimately, with all of these statements of whether or not the duress could have occurred before then or otherwise...
Whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I spoke out of turn there. I did not mean to say harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But ultimately, the biggest problem the defense had with this was at no point can appellant explain why he couldn't have reasonably avoided doing these acts by simply paying Mr. Mattson lawfully any money that Mr. Mattson believed he was owed.
What if they didn't owe him any money?
At this point, with the idea of if he didn't owe him any money or he did, he was willing to steal his roommate's checks and cause his roommate harm rather than simply being out the money himself, none of this would makes any sense. And it's a gigantic hole in the theory of duress. And that is why the members properly rejected the theory at court-martial.
Counsel, on page 3 of the slip opinion, the Court of Criminal Appeals refers to appellant's failure to testify at trial on this defense. Is that an appropriate factor for the court to take into account in weighing either error or prejudice in this case? I'm not asking whether the court could or could not take that into account in the abstract, but in the specific context of this case, was there any requirement for the defense to testify?
There's certainly no requirement, Your Honor.
So if there's no requirement to testify and there's a privilege here, how can the court, on the issue of either prejudice or error, take into account the accused's exercise of his constitutional statutory rights not to testify?
There's no way to take it into account as in deciding whether or not the appellant was prejudiced or whether the military judge abused his discretion. But it is important, again, Your Honor, as you said, in the abstract, that if appellant sought to have a defense of duress exist, there certainly is a need to testify, that he had to take the stand to be able to explain away these inconsistencies. It can't
that's
be helped.
A practical matter for how you might engage in trial practice. I understand that. I'm just having a little trouble figuring out what that sentence is doing in the Court of Criminal Appeals opinion.
I think they're speaking to the same as I did there. Not that they are saying that in any way shaped their opinion on whether or not the military judge abused his discretion. And the lower court actually didn't address whether or not, even if the military judge did abuse his discretion, whether it would be harmless, but that they were just simply pointing out that in the abstract, if a defense of duress is meant to be used, it's almost impossible to do so without the appellant testifying. If there are no further questions, the government would respectfully request that this court affirm the findings and sentence as a judge approved and affirmed below.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from the amicus representing the appellee in this case, or speaking on behalf of the appellee in this case.
Chief Judge, may I proceed? Thank you. Good afternoon, and may it please the Court, Lori Papel, amicus for the government, and seated with me today at government table is brief writer Jennifer D.C. Your Honors, the military judge acted properly when he excluded portions of hearsay statements, character evidence, and testimony lacking probative value offered by defense witness Donnie Mathis. This was not a mechanical application of the rules of evidence to defeat the ends of justice. In fact, justice was served. In fact, the military judge prevented unreliable and prejudicial testimony from affecting the fact finder's deliberations. We support the government's position and ask that you uphold the rulings of the military judge as affirmed by the lower appellate court, because examination of the rulings under the abuse of discretion standard shows that the military judge's actions were not arbitrary, fanciful, or clearly unreasonable. Analysis under the Weeks test reveals that any alleged errors did not materially prejudice a right of the defendant, and that whether the proper testimony had been admitted, the strength of the government's case would have conclusively defeated the defense asserted, and therefore any alleged error is harmless. In reviewing the military judge's evidentiary rulings for abuse of discretion, this court must find more than a mere difference in opinion. It must find that the rulings were arbitrary, fanciful, clearly unreasonable, or clearly erroneous in order to invalidate them. Now, when the government properly objected to specific portions of Mathis's testimony, the military judge solicited argument from trial and defense counsel in an Article 39 fashion. He ruled to exclude the evidence based on their articulation as well as his knowledge of the law.
Did you agree there were 5 statements in play, or how many statements?
There are
how many statements are in play? That's a better way of saying
it. So there's one hearsay statement, related fund matching to Mathis, which is being offered for two different purposes. There's also the statement, excuse me, referring to Mathis's ownership of a gun at an unspecified point in time, and there's also the statement as to Mathis's character.
The government was asked about the relevance, the judge's ruling on relevance, and the government stated that it was the weakest of the judge's rulings, but nonetheless not an abuse of discretion. Is there a difference of view between you and the government on any of the statements, as you've heard the government's argument and read their brief?
Yeah, we agree with the government's argument.
So with respect, for example, to the judge's ruling that the admission of the gun, ownership of the gun information, that was not relevant, you're in the same place as the government.
Yes, Judge Baker, we agree with the government in that Mathis's testimony as to Mathis's access to firearms, that he owned a gun at some point in time, he did not even specify when he actually seen this gun, on Mathis's person, this access to firearms and ownership is not probative of whether or not Mathis had a gun at the time that the offense occurred.
But aren't those questions for cross-examination, the ones that you just, the facts that you just stated as reasons that made it not probative evidence in this case?
Well, Your Honor, the military judge found that there was no direct testimony as to this gun even being at the barracks on the day that the crime was committed, and therefore it could not be admitted as to whether or not he owned a gun. There was no relevance at that point. There was no evidentiary foundation laid when the defense was bringing up this ownership of a gun by Mathis. Your Honor, the lower appellate court refused to overturn the rulings of the military.
Counsel, how do you answer the appellant's contention that they needed to have Mathis testified because he was the only neutral witness, that everything else was either self-serving hearsay by the accused himself or of a similar nature, and that basically they needed someone neutral and believable to effectively prevent this defense?
Yes, Judge Stuckey, we agree with the government in that the characterization of Mathis as a neutral, or excuse me, Mathis as a neutral party would not necessarily be correct in this case. And so therefore, just because he would have testified as to other evidence does not necessarily mean that he was critical and essential to the defense's case. In fact, looking to the weak...
Well, but isn't that a decision? If the defense has several witnesses, none of which are perfect, and he decides he wants to put up the best one, would it be error to exclude the best one?
If the testimony that the best one was going to give, if that testimony would have been excluded properly by the rules of evidence, then it would be proper to exclude them, even though they were the best. In this case, there was substitute evidence in the record for the testimony that Mathis was going to provide. There was the testimony of Jenica Parker, in which she related threats that had been made towards the appellant if he told anyone about the checks. There was the testimony of the victim, in which that self-serving statement that the appellant made identifying Mathis as the person who held a gun to him. And there's also the statement of Lance Corporal Ravel, who identified an unknown person being at the barracks and demanding a check be deposited in an account. There was sufficient substitute evidence in the record, and this goes to the quality of the evidence that has been excluded and whether or not a substitute exists and when such evidence did in fact exist. Now, the strength of the government's case is another prong that which looks at. In this case, the government presented at trial the two forged checks that had been deposited in the appellant's bank account. The government also presented the signed statement by appellant in which he admitted that he jointly engaged in this check scheme with his friend, Mathis. In this statement to the Criminal Investigation Division, the appellant failed to mention any use of force by Mathis, and he similarly neglected to tell the investigator that Mathis had brandished a gun at the time of the crime. The government's case against the defendant, excuse me, the appellant, was strong and conclusive. Judge Ryan, you had asked earlier for a case on which to look to for the 8833 evidence, the state of mind, and in this case I would cite you to U.S. v. Elliott, which was cited by appellant and amicus for appellant. In this case, the defendant was found in possession of a stolen TV, and he wanted to present evidence that he had told his friends prior to receiving this TV that a friend or an acquaintance was going to give him a TV. This would explain the possession of that TV. He wanted to present evidence of his innocent intent to accept this TV at an earlier time. Now, the Court of Military Appeals in that case found that the believability of the defendant's own testimony, where he said, "I accepted a TV from an acquaintance," would have been bolstered by testimony from other witnesses saying, yes, in mid-May he told us he was going to accept a TV. In that case, a subsequent act was found where the defendant possessed the TV, and then that innocent intention was linked up to a subsequent act. So I would direct your attention to that case. The materiality of excluded evidence is also another prong that Weeks looks at. In this case, Mathis's testimony is not necessarily material to the defense. In fact, it is our contention that Mathis's testimony would have undermined Lupan's defense.
I have just an academic question. I'm obliged to ask it in the open. On page 15 of your brief, you say the Western legal tradition distrusts as unreliable hearsay. Do you mean, are you making an academic point that some traditions favor hearsay? Was that, I was just interested in the sense that I'm wondering which traditions, if any, favor hearsay. It's not a trick question. I picked up on that in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm not allowed to ask you outside of the presence of all counsel, so.
Of course. I'm not aware of any other traditions that do trust hearsay. However, it was just to clarify, it was our Western tradition.
Okay, thank you.
Going back to the materiality of the excluded evidence, it was our contention that Mathis's statements made to appellant in that Mathis is coming to get his money no matter nothing in any way possible, those statements would have put appellant on notice that Mathis was coming, and Judge Stuckey, as you pointed out, would have given him time to actually defend or protect himself from this alleged aggressive character. Your Honors, also, the testimony that appellant was shook up after hearing that Mathis was coming to get his money, this testimony was not probative of appellant's state of mind at the time of the crime. The law is clear in that in order for appellant to claim a defense of duress, he has to have this reasonable apprehension of immediate death or bodily injury, and that the reasonable apprehension of fear must continue throughout the occurrence of the offense. Now, the stealing of the checks, the forgery, the depositing, this took place over a 3-week period. And, Your Honors, I see that my time has...
Does that mean you disagree that in theory you can have continuing duress? What if the drug dealer said, if you tell anybody about this, I will not only kill you, but your friends as well and your family?
Your Honor,
would you then consider not telling anybody else? Not you, but a person?
Yes, Your Honor, we would agree with the government in that the facts of this case do not necessarily go towards a continuing duress. The theory of the defense's case is that it was a one-time deal where Mathis had a gun and held the gun up to him. And
so, like the government, you would say the issue here is factual, not theoretical? You would agree that you could have, as a matter of legal theory, a continuing duress?
Yes, Your Honor, we would agree. If I may briefly conclude?
You may conclude briefly. Yes.
Thank you. The findings of the lower court and of the military judge must remain undisturbed. The appellant was not materially prejudiced by exclusion of evidence that took place in the reasoned procedure, and the error is harmless. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
First, Chief Judge Efron, specifically the quote at issue related from Dominic Mathis to the witness testifying, Donnie Mathis, was that Roberson threw some of Mathis's drugs out the window when the cops were behind him or something, and Mathis was telling me it was maybe near $800 worth of stuff. Mathis was like that he's going to go to Jacksonville and get his money back from Roberson. He was like he was going to get his money back, not matter nothing, if you don't cooperate with him. And that is from page 827 in the record. Turning to question, which Judge Stuckey questioned me a bit about, whether the evidence that was excluded was cumulative. I think considering that the credibility was such a central issue as it pertained to the defense, that it could not be considered cumulative to the point that it should be excluded. Lance Corporal Roberson was placed in a situation where he had to present his defense of duress to the members and had to do that beyond the self-serving statements, or it could be argued, were self-serving statements that were already in front of the members. And indeed, when the government, the trial counsel, argues that that should not be given any credence, then the issue of credibility becomes even
more
important. What
did the government's argument that Mathis wasn't the neutral witness, wasn't a neutral witness?
Your Honor, I would say that the record doesn't... He may have been considered himself friends, but the relationship was not all that extensive between them. They had worked together and were on good terms. I don't believe that there's evidence to suggest that he would necessarily...
What in the record would you cite to as your best argument for why we should place Mathis in the neutral rather than friend or non-neutral category?
Your Honor, I would say it had to do with his answers into how he knew Lance Corporal Roberson, the fact that they interacted at work and worked together in the galley.
Did you finish on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Getting to whether we should apply a constitutional prejudice test or not, if indeed there's error, and what that test should be, the government suggested heart of defense as a standard. Do you care to suggest the standard you would hope the court used or should use?
Yeah, I think that language actually gets to the point quite adequately. I think the three words of relevant, material, and vital also accomplish the same fact, materiality going also really to the...
Perceive a difference between the two?
I do not, Your Honor. Again, Your Honor, when talking about whether the evidence was cumulative, I think, as I pointed out, Lance Corporal Roberson was in a position where he had to put on some evidence. Credibility was at issue, as the trial counsel made it, even when arguing. And you really don't have just one single statement, but taking together, I think, is where we think the analysis should take us. And as the government pointed out, that really was a fact finding when discussing whether there was imminence. It was a fact finding issue, and it was determined on a case by case scenario. And we believe that's exactly the point. How much weight to accord this evidence, whether it was credible, really is the issue that the members should have decided. Whether that they would have, maybe they wouldn't have, but I think the evidence suggests that there's a likelihood that they might have given the defense more credence, or more importantly, that they might have decided that the government did not meet its burden of proving that it did not exist beyond a reasonable doubt. So to conclude, the military judge in this case misapplied the law when he excluded the crucial defense evidence that demonstrated Lance Corporal Roberson's fear of Dominic Madsen, and Dominic Madsen's intent to get his money back from Roberson. Accordingly, it prevented Lance Corporal Roberson from preventing a complete evidentiary basis for his defense, and the appellant respectfully requests that this court set aside findings and sentence. If there are no further questions from the court, this concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our argument for the case today. We express our appreciation to